How are you? Recovered from Spot, wherever else you were yesterday. Hi. So I think this is it. This is the final session.
Yep.
Wow. And I hope that you guys got a lot out of it, and you'll come back again, maybe even stay. And you know, as I said, you heard many, many times from everybody. Let me just catch my breath here. That inspiration is very great, but really, if it doesn't carry over into everyday life, it's just a passing fad. So anything meaningful has to be something that you incorporate into your life. So anyway, I think today was, again, a question and answer. And if you have no questions, if everything is absolutely clear to you, I can talk about something else. Yeah.
What's your interpretation of what the Torah says about like how we should handle the Gaza Strip and all this Palestinian crisis and the whole situation?
Well, first of all, any person who believes in God understands that prayer and Torah study and mitzvot are absolutely essential. Now, that may not make rational sense, but you know, we need God to help us, because the whole danger that we face, not just from the Palestinians, but from the Arab world, from Islamic fundamentalism, from Islam fascism, or whatever it is really an enemy that we have not faced before. Because every other enemy we've always had, it has a fear of death. Even the Nazis, who represent the epitome of evil, ultimately, if it came to their own survival, they were willing to give things away. You know, so at the end of the war, all right, there was Hitler, some of the very top guys committed suicide, but a lot of the Nazis were willing to trade Jews to save their skins and the like. The whole Cold War between the United States and the former Soviet Union that lasted for 50 or so years after World War II was predicated on the notion of mutual assured destruction, the arms race called MAD, meaning Russia's not going to bomb us because they know we'd bomb them and they don't want to die. And that kept somewhat of a peace in the world. But when you have an enemy who doesn't care about dying, when you have an enemy that glorifies death, then literally any of your conventional political and military strategies aren't going to work. So this is an extraordinarily dangerous enemy, simply because conventional deterrence doesn't work. Therefore, we need God especially. But in terms of what the Torah says about disengagement, let me make a very interesting point. In halachic theory, and I use the word theory in the sense of, as opposed to practicality in a moment, halachic theory says that the saving of Jewish lives is actually more important than even the land of Israel. As important and as holy as the land of Israel is, if we would be convinced that giving up land would save and maximize Jewish security, the security of a Jew, of a person, is more important than even the holiness of the land. We would even give back Jerusalem. If, now this is why I say theory, if it could be established, this would maximize Jewish security. So we are not fanatics about the land. We believe the land is ours, and we believe the land was given to us by God. But like everything else, you violate the Shabbat to save a life, you violate Yom Kippur to save a life, we would even give back land to save lives. Now, the reason why I call this a theory is because it's just not true in the real world. Halacha would, in theory, permit giving back territory if it'll maximize security. Our experience has been exactly the opposite. As you give back territories, whether it's Gush Katif, Gaza, and the like, what you're doing is you're bringing terrorists into your front door. You're bringing them closer and closer to your cities. And in spite of the fact that Israel has acted in tremendous good faith in trying to make peace with terrorists, even in terms of dismantling beautiful Jewish settlements, all I can say is territorial concessions have been an abject failure. So my point basically is, it's not that we're against giving back land if it could maximize security, but the reality is that it jeopardizes people rather than protecting them. So as a result, therefore, you know what they say, there's an old saying, that a conservative is a liberal that's been mugged. Meaning, once you've been mugged, you know, you're not so liberal anymore because you've experienced it. I to speak personally, I am more or less a dovish type of person. Maybe because I come from America, I think, let's sit around the table, let's make peace, let's talk, we'll work something out. If we only understand each other, we could come to some type of peace. But that's not the Middle East, unfortunately. You're dealing with a culture, the Arab culture or the Islamic culture, which sees conciliation as a sign of weakness. It sees compromise as a failure of nerve. And as a result, instead of saying, oh, you've met us halfway, we'll meet you halfway, it's you've met us halfway, we'll get the other half now. So it's very, very unfortunate and very, very sad. But these kids on the other side of the street, or maybe not here, but in Gaza and the like, they are indoctrinated from the age of 3 or 4 to hate Jews, to hate Israel. I once saw a version of Sesame Street.
Seen that?
You know, they have shooting machine guns, against Israel. This is what a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old kid sees. So we're dealing with a very hopeless situation, and it is remarkable. I think it's a tremendous credit to Israel, both in terms of their containing the situation and in terms of the morality that they bring to bear. The IDF is a highly moral army. It's just very, very amazing, much more so than even the United States. The IDF does not do aerial bombings generally. With Gaza it was different, in areas that have terrorists, because they want to go house to house, even though they're putting themselves at risk. But I would say too that precisely when the situation is hopeless, that reminds us very much that without Hashem, without God, we're going to fail. So in many, many ways, it maybe causes us to turn to Hashem in a deeper and stronger way. So that's a long answer, but I hope you get the perspective. I guess the main point I wanted to bring out to you is that halachic Judaism, although we glorify so much the holiness of the land of Israel, in the hierarchy of values, peace and safety of the Jews is higher than land, and therefore in principle we will do whatever we can to get peace. But all I'm saying is this experiment has not worked.
So I accept the Torah as ultimate authority, right?
Yep.
But I choose on a day-to-day not to keep every mitzvah,
yep.
Right? And that makes me no less Jewish. Can somebody convert into Judaism under those, I guess, conditions of I accept the Torah, but I'm not?
That is a very, very excellent question, not only theoretically, but actually quite, quite practically, because there are quite a few people who would like to convert to Judaism that have exactly this attitude. A little background first. We know that there is, of course, a process of conversion whereby a non-Jew gets a Jewish soul. It's an amazing thing. Actually, there's a little bit of an argument exactly. Do I say that when you convert, you get a new Jewish soul? Or do I say that non-Jews who eventually convert were born with a Jewish soul and now they're simply expressing what is already within them? There's some debate Kabbalistically about how that works. But what are the requirements for conversion if somebody is non-Jewish? How do they convert? So basically, for a man, there are 3 requirements, and for a woman, there are 2 requirements. For a man, the 3 requirements are circumcision. And if you've already had a medical circumcision, there has to be a pinprick on the organ. It's really not as bad as it sounds. It's relatively painless. There is immersion in a mikveh. And then the biggie, which is the hard one, is in front of a rabbinical court of 3 rabbis, you have to affirm that you accept the written and the oral Torah as binding, and you will endeavor to live by those laws. That is called acceptance of the mitzvot. In the case of a woman, mikveh and accepting mitzvot, there obviously is no circumcision. So the conceptual question that you're raising is, what is the meaning of the halachic concept acceptance of mitzvot? Because theoretically one could say, I consider the Torah binding, I consider the Torah, including the oral Torah, as God's law, but I am not yet in a place in my life where I could keep all of it. Either, let's say, I have a job, so I think I'm not ready to quit it and keep the Shabbos, or I'm in a place that doesn't have kosher meat, or I just can't get away from McDonald's. Meaning, you concede what you're doing would be wrong, but you still acknowledge it. So that's a very, very big argument. There are some opinions that say accepting mitzvot equals a commitment to keep mitzvot. And therefore, if the non-Jew says, I accept the Torah, but I'm not going to keep kosher yet, we would not convert him until he, you know, actually keeps kosher. Others say that acceptance of mitzvot does not necessarily equal actually doing them, because after all, even very good Jews don't do all the mitzvot. We all have our sins. But it's primarily referring to accepting it as divine and the like. So I would tell you that this is a very controversial area, because there are quite a few people who want to convert to Judaism, who consider the Torah binding, but they're not yet able to live by it. So there are two views. The stricter view would be not to accept them. Now, you might say, but that's unfair, because if I'm a Jew and I come to Or Sameach, and, you know, so the people tell me, be gradual, take your time, you know, if you're not ready for something, you'll be ready. And yet, when it comes to the non-Jew, we basically say 100% or get out. Meaning to say, 99% isn't good enough, it has to be 100%. Why are we differentiating between the way we treat the non-Jew who wants to convert versus the Baal Tshuva? The Baal Tshuva is the one who's born Jewish, but, you know, is coming closer. In other words, when it comes to the Baal Tshuva means the one that is in the process, we believe in gradualism. When it comes to the convert, we kind of say all or nothing. Why is there that difference? It is a very excellent question. I would just suggest that if you have a very similar difference in citizenship. You know, if you are a born American, you are born as a U.S. citizen, you can be pretty ignorant of the Constitution. No one's going to ask you any questions and the like. In fact, sometimes they even have on these comedy shows, or, you know, they have interviews of who's the Vice President of the United States, or who is your congressman. You know, and people don't know anything about it. If you're born into the club, so you're considered Jewish even if you're ignorant, and then we want to educate you and help you. On the other hand, if you want to be a naturalized citizen, if you're a person, you know, from another country who wants to be an American citizen, you have to know the Constitution, you have to take a test. So in a sense, conversion is a higher standard because you weren't born into it, and therefore we do impose a greater standard. By the way, apropos of nothing, but it just reminds me, have you heard of Kurt Gödel? Kurt Gödel was a very, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, he was a very, very brilliant mathematician. He was a friend of Einstein's. And Kurt Gödel developed a whole theory that all mathematical postulates are built on first principles that cannot be proven. Meaning they're so axiomatic that they cannot be proven. You cannot prove, and therefore ultimately all systems could be incoherent because none of them are provable. So the story goes that when he came to the United States and he wanted to be an American citizen, he had to take a test on the Constitution. But based on his own philosophy, he was able to prove that the whole American governmental system is ultimately incoherent and therefore is not logical, and it's self-contradictory. So he started to tell the judge all of this. So Einstein told him, listen, keep your insights to yourself, just give him the answers. But okay. But the point basically is that if any of you have parents or grandparents who are immigrants who came to the United States, you know that they have to know much more about America than the people who are born. Yeah.
Yeah. So I totally hear what you're saying. So where does the argument come in? So where do you draw the line between a halakhically okay life as a convert? Because obviously even if it's very observant, you don't think of the mitzvah.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So where's the line? Can you be shomer Shabbos and not be kosher? Can you be shomer Shabbos and kosher?
Yeah.
It shows dedication.
You know, yeah, because really you're right, because if you ultimately took the position I just espoused, you would create an impossibility, because everybody sins. Let's take Lashon Hara, right? You're not supposed to say negative things about somebody. So are you telling me, or am I telling you, that a person cannot convert to Judaism if they're ever going to say Lashon Hara about somebody? But that's impossible. I mean, we all do that. So, number one, there has to be the commitment, which is true anyway, that I consider these laws binding. And number two, the idea will be, I will do my best efforts to live up to these standards. So I would say, superficially, that we will not convert somebody unless they commit to what I call the big three. The big three are Shabbos, kosher, And if it's a married couple, the laws of family purity, where for 2 weeks a month, I don't know if you're familiar with this, when a woman has her menstruation, there has to be a separation for 2 weeks, and then the woman goes to the mikveh. Those are called the big three. And then a commitment to keep, to try to keep the other laws to the best of their ability. We certainly... yes, it does. It does include Shomer Nagiyah as well. Yeah. So you're 100% correct. The notion of conversion requires a 100% observance would be definitionally impossible. It does require a 100% commitment to try to do the observance. Yeah. By the way, one other thing about conversion, this may be relevant to some of you, that is, there is a provision. Normally, conversion is something done by an adult. An adult, of course, just means 13 for a boy or 12 for a girl. But there is a mechanism in halacha for the conversion of babies or children. And this happens a lot with adoption. Sometimes if a Jewish couple cannot have biological children, they adopt. And often they adopt a non-Jewish child, number one, because it's easier. There are more non-Jewish children available for adoption. And then the child gets converted. Now, how do you convert? Let's say you adopt a six-month-old baby. How do you convert the baby? Well, if it's a boy, once again, circumcision. And if it's a girl, girl and a boy, or a boy, you put them in the mikveh. Now, what do I mean put them in the mikveh? I don't mean you take a baby and throw him in the mikveh, but it means dad goes into the mikveh, wearing a bathing suit and a t-shirt, and dad holds the baby over his arm and he just lowers the baby gently into the water. By the way, kids love it, babies do love it, because it reminds them of the womb. It's nice room temperature water, and it's important that the baby hit the water face first, because there's actually a swimming reflex. They hold their breath naturally. And it's very, very cute. Up to 6 months, babies do the dog paddle in the water. They go paddle away. So it's actually better to put a baby in the mikveh less than 6 months than older. After 6 months, they lose the reflex. They might swallow a little water, and it's a little uncomfortable. Now, the question is, okay, we got the circumcision and we got the mikveh, but where do you get the acceptance of commandments? The answer is, the parents do it as a surrogate. The parents agree that they will raise the child in accordance with the Torah. But here is the interesting rub. Since this was not a commitment the kid made, this was a commitment the parents made, when the kid reaches bar mitzvah, they have the right to renounce their conversion if they don't want to be Jewish. A regular adult convert cannot. Judaism is a one-way door. Once you become Jewish, you are Jewish. If you convert to Christianity or Islam, you are still Jewish in the eyes of Judaism. Judaism does not recognize conversion out. We only recognize conversion in. The one exception is the conversion of a minor where it was not the minor's decision. He can renounce. But there's a common misconception. People think the child has to reconvert by going to the mikveh again. That is not true. The way it works is, if the kid does not renounce, in other words, unless there's an active renunciation, he will remain Jewish because of the original conversion. There is no need to go to the mikveh again. Well, yes. Once again, an Orthodox rabbinical court, again, this is a very big problem that people face, will not convert a child unless the parents are agreeing to raise the child Orthodox. Yeah.
Are you still bound by those big three then? So I'm going to give you a hypothetical.
Yeah.
Here. Let's say the parents were not Shomer Nagiyah, but they were Shomer Shabbos. They were, they kept that kosher household.
Yep.
And you have two parents who adopted a child, who couldn't have a child.
Yep.
Now, is that child held that not Jewish by the courts because they didn't keep that third of the big three? Are they still bound by those?
Okay. These are really complicated questions. And here is the thing. If the parents were not keeping two out of the three, Shabbos and kosher, that would affect the conversion of the child. But if the only thing they were failing was the third one, this is a very interesting subtlety. Since the laws of marital separation have nothing to do with how the kid is raised, so although it might affect the conversion of an adult who says, I don't want to keep that, it would not affect the conversion of the child, because that's not something that pertains to to how you're raising the kid. So there are subtleties in what is so important. In other words, the family purity laws are extremely important for the conversion of adults. They are perhaps less relevant for the conversion of a child. Did you have a question, Sarinetta? Yeah.
Let's say a Jew loves Judaism, believes 100% believes in the Torah.
Yeah.
But they believe 99% is like 1% where it goes against their values and morals,
right,
that they learn growing,
right,
up in like a secular world.
Right.
Do they have to do they have to just believe in that 1% that they can't see eye to eye, or do they stick to what they believe in?
Well, listen, all of us understand that becoming an observant person is a process, not a final overnight change. And it's important to understand that even if I can't accept everything right now, but I take what I'm able to take and I move with it, and hopefully the idea will be I'll have greater insight. And I want to tell you that no matter how many years you've been observant, and no matter how much Torah you've learned, you know, we always have questions. There are many, many things in the Torah that I cannot claim that I fully understand, and that perplex me and that bother me. I think eventually the hope would be that you would understand that if God gave you a system that seems to be so good 99% of the time, I'll give God credit that the other 1% makes sense as well, because there's a lot of things that I know I don't understand. But I would just say that if you're not in a place where you're able to go there yet, that should not stop you from incorporating what you're able to incorporate. It's important to understand, you know, Voltaire, I think I mentioned it before, Voltaire once remarked that the best is the enemy of the better. That means we want something to be perfect, so if we can't have it 100%, we don't do anything. And that's a real problem, because whatever you do is worthwhile. So stick with it, and just know that questions are always legitimate. And problems are always legitimate as long as they're coming from respect and humility. When you just want to put something down, you know, you're just being a harasser. But if you genuinely want to understand, and there are things in the Torah that don't make sense to you, you are entitled to ask. Maybe you'll get an answer, maybe you won't. But your questions are worthy of respect, and they're worthy of being considered. And, you know, you grapple with it, and hopefully, you know, we all get wiser at least as we get older. Yeah.
You mentioned renouncing a Jewish faith a couple times earlier.
Yep.
I'm just curious, is that a formal process? Do you have to go through any process, or is it more of like a casual, like, I renounce my faith?
Yeah, you go in front of a rabbinical court of three rabbis, converts you, so you go in front of a rabbinical court of three rabbis, and you just declare. It's very simple, just say, I don't want to be Jewish. Now, one interesting question, again, I don't want to get into technicalities, but these are real questions. As you know, I was a synagogue rabbi for many years, so I faced a lot of these questions practically. And that is, what does it mean to renounce Judaism? What if I want to be a Jew, but I don't want to be an Orthodox Jew anymore? Meaning, you imagine a kid that was adopted by an Orthodox family, and he was raised Orthodox, and he likes being Jewish, but he doesn't want to, you know, keep all these laws anymore. So he says, you know, I want to be Jewish, but I don't want to keep the Torah. Is that called renouncing of Judaism, so he gets out of the whole system? Or do I kind of say, well, sorry, as long as you want to be Jewish, you're stuck. So if you don't want to keep the mitzvot, that's too bad. You're committing a lot of sins, but that's not enough to get you out of Judaism. It's an interesting, you know, it is an interesting question. The great, great Rabbi Chaim Ozer of Vilna, one of the greatest rabbis of the 20th century, he died in 1940. He did say explicitly, exactly as you said, so you're shaking your head in the back, so you are correct, that as long as you want to be a member of the Jewish people, you have not renounced your Judaism, even if, unfortunately, it's very sad, you've renounced your desire to keep the commandments. So the renunciation would have to be very unusual. The person literally says, and that's why it's very rare, very rare, I don't want to be a Jew anymore. That would be a very, very serious statement to make. And I'm actually not aware, I tell you the truth, I am not aware of anybody going that far. I've come across many adolescents who simply say, I don't want to keep the commandments anymore. But to say, I don't want to be a Jew, you know, that would be a very serious issue with his parents. And, you know, but I make a joke to parents of adopted children. that they shouldn't be too hard on the kid before their bar mitzvah. You know, before a bar mitzvah, the kids make the parents make the kids prepare Torah reading and all sorts of things. It's a lot of pressure. So I say, don't be too rough on the kid. The day before the bar mitzvah, he might just say, I don't want to be Jewish anymore. And then you're going to lose your deposit on the hall and the caterer, all sorts of things. So be gentle. Yeah.
Is what is morally good commanded by God because it is morally good, or is it morally good because it is commanded by God?
Wow, one of the great, great, great philosophical questions. That is, yeah, great, great question. What is the nature of morality and goodness? Is morality and goodness a function of divine command? Or is divine command reflecting a pre-existing idea of justice and goodness? Did God command it because it's good? Or is it good only because God commanded? Excellent, excellent question. Again, as you might expect, philosophers debate this, Jewish philosophers debate this. Maimonides' position clearly is that there's an antecedent idea of morality, which God's commandments are reflecting. And I'll bring you two proofs to that idea, that morality can be antecedent. Proof number one is that we find that even God can be held accountable if there's a lack of justice. When Abraham is pleading for the city of Sodom, Abraham says, how can you destroy the city if there are any righteous people at all? Remember, Abraham was bargaining, and he says, can the judge of the world be unjust? Now, if you think about it, if goodness is defined solely in terms of God's will, then it would be logically impossible to have any claim of injustice against God because, hey, he makes the rules. Only if there's an antecedent notion of morality can the Almighty, as it were, be held to account. So that's proof number one. Proof number two, maybe this is not a great proof, but I think it is a proof, or at least a piece of evidence, is that there's a concept in Judaism of not just following the law, but going beyond the law, looking at the spirit rather than the letter, going beyond the law. Now it seems to me, if the definition of good is only that which is commanded, there can be no concept of going beyond what was commanded because goodness is defined only by what was commanded. If we tell a person, go beyond, that suggests there is some idea of goodness that maybe has not been made mandatory, but which one should still aspire to. So it's a very, very excellent question, and it's something to think about and study, and as they say, different thinkers have spoken about this. Yeah.
So, there's two perspectives that folks are going to pose. But so the idea that if you are, we have a duty to honor our parents. If your parents, for example, like your parents, not supposed to eat that, they're diabetic, they're supposed to take care of their body. That's considered a mitzvah. Where does our line draw of where we're supposed to take the food away from them?
Yep.
Or is that considered disrespectful and it's still their decision? The same with you, or if you have very observant parents who decide to stop keeping Shabbos, where does the line draw between honoring your parents and telling or being disrespectful and telling them?
Yeah, these are again really on the ball today. Everyone's asking such great questions, and these are again not just theoretical questions. These are real questions that people are going to face. Let me just add a third example to you, and that is when do you take Dad's car keys away? You know, when the elderly at some point, it might become very dangerous for them to drive, but a loss of mobility, taking away somebody's ability to drive, can be very, very devastating in terms of their psychological well-being because that takes away like the last vestige of control they might have over their lives. On the other hand, let somebody danger to themselves and to other people drive on the highway or whatever it would be. So the answer basically is that there is a balance here because part of honoring parents is respecting their dignity. And sometimes respecting their dignity means you have to let them make choices, even if they're the choices that are not best for them. But part of their dignity is to give them the right to make even bad choices. So within limits, you kind of let them do things that you would rather they not do. But there are going to be limits. At the point at which they are doing things that are dangerous to them or to other people, then you have to step in. If Dad will go into a diabetic shock if he'll have a piece of cake, then you can't let him have the piece of cake. If he's really danger on the road, you can't give him the car keys. But you have to figure out a way to do it in a way that maximizes their dignity and spares them from embarrassment. So you don't simply say, "Dad is eating a piece of cake." You don't say, "Dad, no, pull it away." You don't treat a parent like a child. That is very, very humiliating. And you even have to ask yourself, you know, you have to know ahead of time, well, if Dad has one piece of cake, is that gonna be bad? You know, a diabetic can have sometimes, depending, you know, a little bit. But then you gotta develop strategies, like being sure there's no cake in the house. In other words, do things that are not invasive, that are not embarrassing, that are not humiliating. And if one misstep is not going to be dangerous, then, you know, let him do the one misstep and then take corrective action for the future. It's a very difficult balancing act because you have to balance safety, and the Torah commands us to preserve life. That's a commandment in the Torah, versus dignity. Now, with respect to your last question, which is really a very different question, that is the parent that is non-observant. So let me just make two points. Point number one is, vis-a-vis you, if your parent asks you to do anything that violates Torah, if your parent asks you to go shopping on Shabbos or pick up the cleaning on Saturday, you don't listen to him. That, now, you still have to do it respectfully. You say, "Dad, I'll go after Saturday, I'll go Monday or Sunday," or whatever it is. Now, vis-a-vis what they're doing, however, generally speaking, it is not a child's job to correct parents, unless the parents want to be corrected. Meaning, if my parent is not keeping Shabbos, it would be very sanctimonious and presumptuous to say, "Hey, Dad, you're not allowed to watch TV on Shabbos." I mean, you know, what's going to be the father's reaction? I mean, he's not going to welcome that. So basically, you respect your parents and you understand that people make their own decisions, and it's not your place to correct. Now, if Dad, let's say, is in the process of becoming religious, and there are things they don't know that you've learned, then by all means, in a respectful way, fill them in on the details because they want to know. But if they're not in that modality, you know, in fact, it's not just for parents. The truth is for anybody. You have all sorts of friends who don't keep Shabbos. Are you supposed to go back to college campus and start telling people, like get on a soapbox and say, "One is not allowed to do texting on Shabbos"? I mean, what are people going to think? Are people going to respond to that, or are they going to think you're crazy? One has to be very, very careful that you primarily teach by example, not by lecture. Meaning to say, you're a person who keeps Shabbos, you're a person who treats people with respect. People are going to, you know, take notice of that. But you don't give people lectures, and you certainly don't do so to your parents. So, you know, you got to be very, very careful. Yeah?
How important is living in the land of Israel philosophically, like not for your own nationalism?
Yeah. Again, excellent, excellent question. I guess you're getting tired of this answer already. Everything is an argument. We have many, many discussions in Judaism. According to the great Nachmanides, who's called Ramban, living in the land of Israel is one of the 613 commandments of the Torah, meaning the Torah commands us to live in Israel. According to Maimonides, it is not technically a commandment, but it's a great, great thing, because you're closer to God here. Now, I think I mentioned the other week that although God is everywhere, our capacity to receive godliness is stronger in certain places, like cell phone reception. So living in Israel is a very, very important thing. Now, it doesn't mean it's for everybody. And there are many, many good Jews who don't live in Israel. Right? And God forbid, I wouldn't disparage them. And there are reasons not to live in Israel. And one needs to think about this. One is allowed to stay in outside of Israel in order to preserve marital harmony, get married and marital harmony. Sometimes, as strange as this might be, it may not be the best place for your children, especially once they're adolescents. To uproot adolescent kids could be very, very traumatic. Sometimes you have to take care of elderly parents, and there are going to be reasons. And then we have the rabbi's exception. Sometimes as a rabbi, although sometimes rabbis, maybe we over-exaggerate our importance, we are so vitally important to our congregation that we can't possibly leave because there's no way that we can be replaced. Now, one has to be careful in applying that paradigm, but sometimes that is really true. That is genuinely true. So what I'm saying is, none of us say that 100% of the Jewish people have to come here. That's not going to happen until Mashiach. But the one thing I will say is, every single Jew must ask himself the question, should I be in Israel And if my answer is no, why not? Unless you have specific reasons, a Jew should live here. There are specific reasons not to live here, and 100%. But you can't just answer it by default. And that's really a big problem of, I think, the American community. That is, too many people don't even have this issue on the radar. And that is very, very unfortunate. We've been praying for 2,000 years, bring us back to the land. And we're still praying, bring us back to the land, because we don't have Mashiach and the like. And have you heard of the famous Sefer, the Kuzari? I'm sure it's been discussed. This was a great work of Jewish philosophy, written by Rav Yehuda Halevi, a great poet and philosopher, in the 11th century. And it's based on a dialogue between a non-Jewish king and the rabbi, and the rabbi is discussing with the non-Jewish, the Khazars, discussing about Judaism versus other religions. And Rav Yehuda Halevi wrote both sides of the dialogue. He put the questions in the mouth of the king, and he gives the answers in the mouth of the rabbi. He's writing both sides of the discussion. And in one point of the Kuzari, the king asks Rav Yehuda Halevi, "I don't understand you Jews. You keep on praying about going to Israel, and how come nobody goes?" And Rav Yehuda Halevi said to the king, the rabbi, he really said to the king, "Your Majesty, this is our shame and this is our embarrassment. All of our prayers are like," this is before there was Twitter, "are the twittering of birds." And why should God listen to prayers that are obviously insincere? Now, Rav Yehuda Halevi said that in the 11th century. Do you know what life was like in Israel in the 11th century? Desolate, empty, filled. I remember. Now, filled with, filled with wild animals, marauders. There was nothing here. And yet he said, how could a Jew not go? Today, you have an uncomfortable 12-hour plane ride, to be sure. But you're in a country that has, Ben and Jerry's ice cream and good telephone service and toilet paper and Skippy peanut butter. All of the luxuries. It's not America, that's true. Right? But here's the point. The point basically is, it's so embarrassing to say, I can't live in Israel because I don't like the grape juice here. Is that what it's going to turn into? So all I'm saying is there are good reasons not to live in Israel. 100%. I am not a fanatic, and I'll tell you, as the joke goes, and it's not a joke, I was much more pro Aliyah before I made Aliyah than afterwards. Meaning, when I was in America, everybody got to go to Israel. When I come to Israel, I see that it's not for everybody. But everybody has to ask the question. You need to address this. You cannot just ignore it. Hashem gave us a great gift. We have to ask ourselves, why am I not ready to take it? Yeah.
Well, backtrack to a question of God and judgment, how do you judge God?
Yes.
You mentioned antecedents. I'm not sure exactly what you mean. Is there something outside of God to judge God?
Okay. We're going to get it. Yeah. Okay, you guys are too smart. I didn't want to get into a circular argument, but you are correct. There is a certain circularity here. Nothing is outside of God. But what I mean to say, but something may be outside of the Torah. But by that I mean to say the following. When God determined the commandments of the Torah, God didn't just arbitrarily determine them and then they become good. Rather, there was a concept of what is good and what is moral, and God kind of chose from those concepts which of them would be commandments and which of them would be left to aspirations. Now, in an ultimate sense, God is the architect of the morality itself, but it is a morality that is beyond the Torah and even before the Torah. It was the basis of the Torah. Instead of the Torah being the basis of the morality, there was a morality and a goodness that emanates from the very nature of God, of which the Torah is a reflection. That's what I mean outside of the Torah. It can't be outside of God per se, but when we say when God is called on being judged, basically the argument is you are not living by the standards of morality that you God deemed to be good. Yeah.
So of what, I'm going to go back to your original prior to this question. So at what point are you supposed to evaluate when you should come to Israel?
because if you're in the United States, I mean, as someone who went to undergraduate and graduate school in the United States,
yes,
if you know your continuing education in the United States, is that a legitimate reason to say, I'll evaluate this when I finish my education?
Well, I think realistically it is. I mean, I think that is a pretty good reason. Meaning, I'm going to medical school, I'm going to law school, etc. I do want to finish. On the other hand, I would just add that when you assess your career path, you need to assess it having in mind that you might want to go to Israel. So your very choice of occupation should be dictated in some way with at least the possibility of making Aliyah. But yeah, I think staying for schooling is legitimate, although I will say that Israel, you know, we have colleges here too, and we have programs here, even for English speakers. So, you know, you can have an educational experience here as well. I'm sorry, there was some people, yeah.
We've been having a lot of back and forth freestyle. I'm really curious, what in your opinion is the biggest debate with Judaism?
What is the biggest debate with Judaism? Well, you know, the Jewish people, we have a 2,000-year, 3,000-year history of debates. You know, you open up a page of Gemara. When do we start debating? It's around the second line, the first line of the Mishnah. Okay.
In terms of something about being answered completely, what is your biggest debate in the history of Judaism?
Right now, or you're in the history of Judaism?
Well, something that's still not answered.
Well, I think the biggest debate we have, and this is a very big debate in Israel, is the idea of what does it mean to be Jewish in a non-coercive way, meaning to say Judaism, Torah, is what God wants us to do. But the question is, can that coexist with democracy? Can that coexist with freedom? Israel is described as a Jewish democratic state. Now the problem is that seems to be a contradiction in its very terms, because Jewish says you've got to be a certain way, you've got to do a certain thing. Democracy is premised on autonomy and freedom. One of the most difficult questions that we as a society have to address is, to what degree can authentic, real Judaism coexist with a system of values that's premised on human freedom and autonomy? Can they both exist? I believe they can, but that's going to be a difficult balance. And that goes on every single day in this country as to, are we going to make it Jewish at the expense of freedom? Are we going to allow freedom to override Judaism? Can they coexist? If I live in Jerusalem, can I possibly support a gay rights march through the city? No, this I think is perhaps the central debate of our time, in which both religious Jews and secular Jews on all points of the spectrum have different views, even within each camp. So I think that's quite a big one. Okay, yeah.
If a big problem that comes up is miracles, and the fact that God, it seems to be that God once did miracles, but in our day and age, he doesn't. So, how do we understand that?
Yeah. You know, let me just digress for a moment before I talk about your actual question. You know, we read about one of the great miracles in the Torah about Bilam's donkey. This is one of the most amazing miracles. It wasn't a super dramatic miracle like the splitting of the Red Sea. But here you have this guy, you know, a guy who has this power of cursing everybody, and his donkey starts talking to him because he beats his donkey, because his donkey sees an angel, and the donkey, like, stands still, and Bilam beats the donkey, and the donkey turns around and says to him, hey, you know, what are you doing? You know, I've been around. But to me, the miracle of the miracle is that Bilam doesn't seem fazed with this at all. He just says, I'm going to kill you, move! You know, so I think the greatest miracle is that people don't get impressed with miracles. Now, why is that relevant to this message? Because people say, as Yossi said, people say, in the olden days, there were so many great miracles, the splitting of the Red Sea. If only God would do miracles, then I would believe in him. The truth of the matter is, God does plenty of miracles. If you think about the survival of the Jewish people, you think about the state of Israel, you think about the fact, Mark Twain wrote more than 100 years ago, that the survival, and he was not Jewish, the survival of the Jew is a great miracle. We ought not to exist. Every single civilization has tried to wipe us out, either physically often or spiritually by assimilation. So in many, many ways, we have to redefine maybe what a miracle is. Jewish survival is a miracle, and not just survival, but flourishing, our contribution to civilization. The state of Israel is a miracle. We are blind. We are like Bilam, where a miracle happens in front of your eyes, and you don't even acknowledge it. Now, Ramban makes another point, though. Ramban makes a point that why does the Almighty have to keep proving himself over and over and over again? He did it. He showed you what he could do. He says it's insulting for God to have to go over this over and over and over again. It's like, you know, there was a commercial on YouTube, very, very funny commercial. Shimon Peres, who was president of the state of Israel, it showed him applying for a job, you know, after he left office. He was making an advertisement for a charity. So he applies to a gas station, he applies to a fast food restaurant. And, you know, they keep on asking him, do you have any experience, do you have any credentials, you know. It's a little insulting that the president has to kind of, you know, prove himself. Well, God, the Ramban says, should not have to prove himself over and over and over and over again. He proved himself. He showed us he exists. He showed us he is the master of the universe. We should now accept it. So I would still say, don't deny the miracles that go on every single day. We live in a very miraculous time. Yeah.
This may be, you know, a question of graciousness, but then I ask, why is it when something good happens, we call it a miracle? Something bad happens because something bad happens.
Well, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that. I would say, well, two things. I would say that when something bad happens, it is often also the will of God, and it might be a miracle that something bad happens, and God may have decreed it for reasons that we don't always understand, as an atonement or as a lesson. So that's one thing to keep in mind. So I'm not necessarily saying, you know, give God credit for the good and don't blame him for the bad. God is the architect of everything. All I'm saying is that everything God does has reasons and purposes. So even if there's apparent upheavals and bad things, there is hidden meanings that we don't always understand. The other thing that I would point out, though, is that a lot of evil is a function of human choice. And remember that God did create a world which is predicated on free will. So if the Germans or the Poles or the Ukrainians kill 6 million Jews, one of the things you have to ask yourself is, did God kill 6 million Jews? Or is it the evil decisions of human beings that did that? Meaning, instead of asking where was God in Auschwitz, we could ask, what does Auschwitz say about the human condition? So if there is an asymmetry in the good and the evil, I might chalk it up to the fact that God created a world where human beings have free will, and if God creates a world of free will, there'll be a capacity for evil. Right? But it's not God doing the evil, it's human beings doing the evil. Yeah.
But it's like based off the last thing. But in the past, like the whole Sodom and Gomorrah thing, that's when God stepped in because he did not agree with how a community of people were acting. So that's the whole thing I have a hard time wrapping my head around. Like, if he's done it before, like, this is like a million times worse than anything else, like, that they've ever seen before. It's the chosen people, and it's just like, how would you step in with the fire and brimstone?
That's just a great question. I mean, again, a great question, because God sees a society that's evil and degenerate. And God says such a society should not live. I will destroy this society because of their evil. By the way, just to give you an update on that, you know, all of you have heard of Mount Vesuvius. Pompeii was a Roman city that was destroyed, totally destroyed. In fact, people were like, I guess frozen is not the right word, but they were literally paralyzed in place with lava, you know, in the middle. And the like. Well, do you know that this happened around 50 years after the destruction of the temple? And contemporary Roman historians said this was God's punishment for our destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. At the time of the event, this was identified by the Romans themselves. So that's another Sodom and Amorah type thing. So the question is a very, very poignant question. Here you have the Nazi regime for 12 years. From 1933 to 1945, and the active extermination of the Jews was from 1939 to 1945. Paradigm of evil, the paragon of all that is depraved. How could God not intervene and destroy? Why wasn't there Sodom and Amorah? I don't know. I will tell you, I don't know. It's a very, very painful, difficult question. There are mysteries here. Let me just tell you that the book of Job is filled with grappling of why evil things happen. And at the end of the book, Job is comforted when he feels the presence of God, but he doesn't have an answer to that question. It says Moses asked God, why do the righteous suffer? And God told Moses, I'm not answering. So there are going to be mysteries here. And the man of faith does not have answers. But we feel the presence of God even in tragedy. And this is important to understand that, yes, the Holocaust, I don't know. But the idea that God gave us the strength to rebuild and go on and not just give up in total hopelessness is in itself a gift from God as well, and we have to appreciate that. Now, I remember, I think it was it in Schindler's List? I'm not sure. I think it was an actual interview appended to Schindler's, where a Polish woman was interviewed why she sheltered Jews during the Holocaust at risk to her own life. And she actually said, because God said he would not destroy Sodom if there were 10 righteous people in the city. And if I wouldn't try to do what I could, you know, that we would be destroyed, you know. So, but as I say, these are difficult questions. Yeah?
So if God were going to save Sodom, if there were 10 righteous people, why did he decide that blowing up the Mount Mount Vesuvius that destroyed this entire society?
Well,
it's a form of justice when
There's
no indication that this was at all an immoral society.
Well, you know, again, I don't have, I don't know what Pompeii was like. I can't tell you exactly who there. But let me point out that even with Sodom, see, again, you're hitting on a question. Even with Sodom, you'll notice the argument that Abraham made was not save the city because of the children. You'll notice that he required to be 10 righteous adults in the city.
There were 10 righteous adults in Pompeii.
Well, I have no way of knowing one way or the other. But all I'm saying is the kids would not be enough. And that's a good question, why not? You know, there's actually a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, this is quite amazing, if any of you are pet lovers, that, you know, every Rosh Hashanah, God decides if we're going to live another year. No, God gives us, right? So it says sometimes a person doesn't deserve another year, but God will keep you alive because you're taking care of an animal that needs you. So sometimes you get a favorable judgment because, you know, whatever it is, Rover, you know, needs someone to take care of it. So you never know. You never know why God keeps you alive. Yeah.
So do the mitzvahs and being like a good Jew and all that, I mean, it's important, but what about like the places where like there are no Jews or no one's even heard of a Jew, like, you know, a pygmy tribe in Africa or something like that?
Yeah. So are you talking about what does a Jew do if he's there, or what do they do?
Well, I mean, I guess it's kind of a broad question, but I mean,
how does God expect people who are not introduced to the no God laws?
Yeah. Excellent question. You're an aborigine, you're a pygmy, you're in an isolated place, you're not exposed to either Judaism or the Noahide laws or the Torah. The question is, what does God expect of such a person? And you could even ask it maybe in a more negative way. Why do such people even exist? Like, why are they there? What is their function? What is their purpose in the divine scheme of creation? It is an excellent question. We believe that at least the basic Noahide laws are virtually instinctual, meaning to say you didn't need to hear them from a Jew or learn the Torah. Not killing, not stealing, these are things that, having a sense of God, these are things that we believe are embedded in a person's essential consciousness. So even the pygmy could be expected to know all of this. I will tell you this. This is part of why Kabbalah developed the idea of reincarnation. Reincarnation is not in the Talmud, or it's not explicitly in the Torah, but it's developed by the mystics. And part of what induced them to see the world this way was precisely because so many people seemed to inhabit a life in which they didn't have the potential to achieve these goals and these purposes. So God gives them multiple chances in different frames of existence. But the other thing I would say is this. The ecology of the world is extremely intricate and sensitive. You know, you look at a certain snail and you say, why does this snail exist? Get rid of it. Well, you get rid of it, you'll notice all sorts of things will be happening. You'll have predators and this and that. So let's say you say, well, why are there pygmies? Why are there aborigines? Well, who knows what would happen if they would be eliminated? What consequence to the rainforest? You know, you never know. Meaning to say, God created a world in which everything has a part, and if you change one thing, everything could fall apart, you know? Now, I can say that. I frankly don't understand that, but everything is interlocked in that way. Yeah?
So to go back to what you said about the pygmies who, they have an innate sense, right?
Yep.
An innate sense of what to do.
Yeah.
In terms of the basis. How do we account then for when you have, you know, island tribes that do cannibalism? Like, one of our innate abilities is to not kill each other. And
yes.
Here you have a group of people that kill each other, and that seems to be their innate desire or pedophilia.
Yeah, right. So the question becomes this. There's a lot of unknown history here, and that is the following. Certainly over a course of time, centuries, certain acquired, learned behaviors can just become part of the cultural norm. But we believe that initially these were deviations, meaning to say, at some point in time, people made decisions to behave in evil, perverse ways, and then that became the cultural norm, and at that point the newcomers aren't, you know, they're just indoctrinated in that norm. But we believe that that was not instinctual, that it was counter-instinctual, and then you have environment just takes over at some point. Yeah.
This might not sound good, but just to respond to that comment, you know, a lot of these cultures often get decimated by natural disasters that we don't see in a lot of civilized societies.
Okay, maybe it's God's way of clearing the deck. Okay. Alrighty, is this it? Okay.
guys, we're going to take a break now. If we have any extra time, if anyone wants this. And also, if you're on JM, turns up more time throughout the weeks to ask your questions. So we'll take a break now.
Anyway, it was a real pleasure having you, and come back again.